KaiserNetwork.org.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome former President of the United States, William Jefferson Clinton.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to have a great afternoon plenary. And all the participants are backstage and eager to do it. But we're going to do four commitments first. I would like to ask Sir Michael Somare, Prime Minister of Papua New Guinea, come up, I would like to ask Stephen McCormick, the President and CEO of the Nature Conservancy, Peter Seligman, the Chairman and CEO of Conservation International, Fred Krupp, the President of Environmental Defense, and President Oscar Arias, Costa Rica, to come up. Give them all a big hand. There are two separate organizations involved in this tropical forest commitment, the Nature Conservancy, Conservation International, and Environmental Defense. They will design market-oriented mechanisms to support developing nation efforts to cut carbon emissions from deforestation and land use change, something we were discussing today. This component of the overall commitment is valued at $4 million over 3 to 4 years. Environmental Defense will develop a $6 million carbon fund to engage U.S. farmers and forest owners in reducing net greenhouse gas emissions. They will establish an effective framework to reduce tropical deforestation that mitigates climate change, alleviates rural poverty, and protects biodiversity. And over the life of this commitment, it is valued at approximately $80 million. I want to say that Papua New Guinea and Costa Rica are leading a 15-country coalition for rainforest nations to create a new system of incentives to encourage tropical forest conservation. And here in the U.S., the Environmental Defense will be involved in engaging American farmers and forest owners in the fight against climate change. It's so funny. We were just talking about this morning and how important it is. And I didn't know we'd be announcing a commitment. So I'd like to ask all these participants to come up here, sign on the dotted line, and then we'll get on with it here. Please. Well, you have hands if you like.
Yes, yes.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We'll have our meeting as soon as this is over. I won't be here.
This is so.
Okay, go ahead.
Should I sign two? Got it?
I thought you had.
That's okay.
You take the picture and sign it. How's that? You got the picture. I would like to ask now Raffaello Foglieri, the founder and president of the Foglieri Foundation, to come forward. This commitment is to vaccinate 10,000 children in Honduras against hepatitis A before the end of the year. That's a $1 million commitment. That is in addition to the foundation's previous $50 million commitment to provide free prescription drug discount cards to needy Americans. The Nicaragua vaccine program has already been underway, and they are going to expand it to Honduras. So they've done a great job. Hepatitis A is a huge problem affecting 1.5 million people a year, and Honduras has a big problem with it. The lifetime risk of infection there, according to the World Health Organization and the Centers for Disease Control, is greater than 90%. So they've done a very good thing. You should know that this is part of our efforts to address diseases that are often overlooked beyond AIDS, TB, and malaria. So let's give Mr. Folieri a big hand, and we're going to take this picture. I'd like to ask Jonathan Tisch to come up. John, where are you? Come on up. John Tisch has committed $40 million to endow the Tisch College of Citizenship and Public Service at Tufts University. This gift secures the college, formerly the University College of Citizenship, now is a permanent part of Tufts University, encouraging scholars' civic engagement through interdisciplinary programming and fellowships. John is a Tufts alumnus and a university trustee for the last 18 years. This is the third largest donation in the history of the university and the largest ever by an individual. So I thank him for doing this. As someone who operates a school with a degree in public service, I think it's pretty important, and I'm very grateful. Thank you very much, John. Now, for the benefit of the attendees at the conference, I want to ask Sir Richard Branson to come up here to discuss the commitment that he previously outlined to the press just about an hour and a half ago. And because it's a rather astonishing commitment and the circumstances under which he gave it are unique, I want to give Richard a chance to describe it. But, Richard, where are you? Hello, Senator Glenn. Hi, Annie. How are you? He's not here yet? All right, here's what we're going to do this at the end of the next panel. And he wanted to do this here because he wanted Al Gore to be here and a part of it. So, we're not in this position anymore, but I hereby sign over my authority to Vice President Gore to make this announcement if I'm not back in time. Let's bring the next panel on. Thank you very much.
Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our panelists, President and Chief Executive Officer, Cisco Systems, John Chambers, former Vice President of the United States, Al Gore, President and Chief Executive Officer, Siemens, Klaus Kleinfeld, Founder and Managing Director, Grameen Bank, Muhammad Yunus. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome our moderator, Program Director of Environmental Defense, Peter Goldmark.
I want to welcome our panel. My name is Peter Goldmark. I direct the climate program at Environmental Defense, and I'm just going to give a headline on each panelist. On your left, my extreme right, is Klaus Kleinfeld. He took the leadership of one of Germany's and the world's largest companies, Siemens, a little less than 2 years ago at the age of 45. But what you need to know about Klaus Kleinfeld is that from day one at Siemens, sustainability was one of his key themes. On Klaus's left is Mohamed Yunus, an old friend and fellow warrior. If you haven't walked around a rice paddy with Yunus, you haven't lived. But Yunus is best known to all of you as the creator, founder, and architect of one of the world's most remarkable and successful microcredit organizations, which is now in many other fields, and that, of course, is Grameen. On Yunus's left is a man I'm going to introduce last. I'm going to skip him for the moment, and I'm going to go to John Chambers. John Chambers has been head of the Cisco company for a little over a decade. That means he has not only had a seat at many of the tables and events that have led to the globalization and the creation of an internet economy, it means he and Cisco have helped drive us there. And we look forward to your contribution today. Now, I'm going to ask you to welcome those three panelists, and then I'll introduce our fourth one. Would you join me welcoming those? Now, our fourth panelist is Al Gore, well-known movie star and producer. But I'm going to ask for a special hand for him, and that is not because An Inconvenient Truth was a great film, although it was, and it's not because that film got the climate change argument just right, and it did. This applause is because we saw in this film a man from the public sphere speaking with commitment and integrity and conviction on a subject of global importance that he knew down to its core. And that is a rare commodity these days, and we admire it.
Thank you very much.
Now we're going to do a little work. The first question is going to go to Al Gore, and it's this. If there is a road to sustainability on this planet, many observers would say that neither China nor the United States are on it. What do we have to do to get them there?
Well, thank you, Peter. And ladies and gentlemen, thank you all for taking part in this amazing event and for all the commitments that so many of you are making. It's an honor for me to be... have the privilege to be a part of this distinguished panel. And Peter, thank you for your outstanding work over the years on this issue and on quite a few others. The United States and China are, of course, in very different positions. And to say that those two countries are the only ones not on the road, is one way of framing it. You're not saying they're the only ones, but they're the U.S. is by far the largest economy, and China is the most populous nation and the fastest growing economy. But the differences are important in illuminating what I think is the right answer to your question. The per capita income and the capacity for dramatic change of the kind needed to combat the climate crisis is very different in China than in the United States. The United States and those non-Americans here, I hope, will forgive me for an expression of pride in my country. The United States, I believe, is still the one nation best able to lead the world, and the world needs leadership now. What we're facing is a full-scale planetary emergency. This crisis is without any precedent in all of human history. It is a challenge, first of all, to the moral imagination. How could we be in such a radically new relationship with the planet? We are. We've quadrupled population in less than 100 years. We've adopted technologies that are thousands of times more powerful than those our ancestors had. And we've allowed ourselves to adopt a philosophy of short-term thinking that somehow we think, absolves us from responsibility for the future consequences of present actions. So the United States, being a nation with more resources and more wealth, more experience, and I think a greater inherent capacity to offer and provide leadership for the world, is in a different position. And the United States has to get on the road to solving the climate crisis as a leader of this effort. The United States should be the pace car in the race to combat global warming. We should be out in front, not lagging behind. And in order to get China on this road, the first and most important step is to get the United States on this road. Because China, in some areas, has done more than the United States. In the new five-year plan, environmental factors are now integrated into the calculations of GDP. CO2 reductions are explicitly taken into that plan as part of it. There are emission standards for autos that exceed that in the United States. Their afforestation program is an impressive one. Of course, the shortcomings are many, but the level of knowledge and sophistication is as high among the Chinese leaders and in their scientific community as in any nation in the world. The debate should be treated as something in the past. Scientific American has a new issue this month that is introduced with the sentence, "The debate on global warming is over." It is really an extreme disappointment to me that in this country there are still so many who pretend that the debate is still underway. It's not. It is over. The debate now is on how we can craft emergency solutions to make sure that the United States and China and every nation are on the road to solving this crisis.
Thank you. One of the places the road to sustainability leads is through poor villages in Asia. Eunice, can you take us down to a village and describe a couple of innovations that you're working on, and also tell us why they're scalable?
Well, the first one I should mention, something people talk about microcredit, that microcredit is a very good idea, is a very effective tool to help poor people get out of poverty. But it works only at the top layers of the poor people. It doesn't go in the middle, it doesn't go in the bottom, because they don't have the creativity and the entrepreneurship. And I protest that. I thought all human beings are creative. Some got a chance to bring out their creativity and show it. Some never got a chance to do that because society never allowed them to do it. So what I did to demonstrate it in a more concrete way, I said, let's do exclusively address the beggars in Bangladesh. So that if we can give microloans to the beggars and they come out of begging, that would be a demonstration. Even the beggars have the creativity to get out of poverty, and they have the creativity to move into something else. So we thought maybe there will be 3,000-4,000 beggars in the program, and we'll try it out. It became such a popular program. All we are doing, telling beggars that, well, since you go house to house begging, would you like to carry some little merchandise with you? Some cookies, some candy, something. You're going there anyway. So they said, well, we can do that. So we said, we'll finance you for that. We'll give you loans. And sure enough, they started doing that. A typical loan for a beggar is something like $12. With $12, she has a basket of merchandise she carries around and go house to house. And people love that. And the kids love it. So immediately they start a business. Today we have more than 80,000 beggars in the program. Many of them already quit begging completely. And I'll quickly add one more thing, which we feel very excited about. Last November I was visiting Paris in connection with a meeting, and Frank Ribault of Danone, the chairman of Danone, he invited me for lunch. I said, okay, I know I never met him. So he wanted to understand how microcredit works, how Grameen Bank works. How can people pay back? It's impossible people to pay back. I explained everything, answered all the questions. Then I said, what does Danone do? Tell me. So he explained what Danone does. And he said, we do it in Indonesia, we do it in India, it's a big operation in China. I said, would you care to do it in Bangladesh? Let's have a company, we'll call it Grameen Danone Company. He said, it will do what? I said, it will do something very interesting. It will bring yogurt, it will produce yogurt in Bangladesh, not for yogurt itself. Bangladesh is a country with a lot of malnutrition among the poor children. So we'll fortify that yogurt. We'll put the iodine, we'll put the vitamin, we'll put the iron, zinc, everything that is needed by the children, what is missing in the diet, and then make it available to them.
Sure.
I agree. He extended his hand. Okay, let's do it. I said, okay. But this will be a social business enterprise, meaning that this company will be non-loss company and non-dividend company. You will not get any profit out of it. Profit will be plowed back into it, so you are not expecting any return to come back to you. I said, agree on that one. So starting from November, he sent a lot of his staff to come to Bangladesh, designed the whole thing. The designer who makes the plants, he came over. He said, how big you want the plant? I said, the smallest that you can conceive of, that the littlest plant that you can have. He said, I always make big plants, not the small plants. I said, this time you'll make an exception. You'll make the smallest plant possible, because my idea is if it works, then we'll have a chain of those plants all over the country, so that the local milk will go in and produce the local yogurt, and the children of families or the poor families will eat that yogurt, and the company will continue to do that. He agreed, and he finally made it. He said, I have designed the cutest plant ever and most modern technology of yogurt making. I said, fantastic. So this is in operation. This will go into operation 7th of November this year, and we are all invited to join that. And football star Zidane is coming to inaugurate, along with Frank Ribault. So this will be an example of what is social business enterprise. I'm saying business can be something to do good to people. It doesn't have to be profit maximizing all the time. Some profit maximizing continue to do that. But there will be other kind of companies where you invest to make a difference in the people's life, to put a signature in this planet that you have solved this social problem. Like, if this works in malnutrition case, this can be extended any way you want. So these are the two items I thought I should mention. Thank you.
Is it slowly dawning on you that this panel has three world-class business titans on it? My next question is for Klaus Kleinfeld and John Chambers, and it's this. Many people say that the biggest problem on the road to sustainability is a private corporation. But those of us who say that also know that we will not get where we're trying to go unless the private corporation is part of the solution. So, Klaus, let me ask you first, how do we get from the private corporation being part of the problem to part of the solution?
I've always believed that the economy, doing something that makes economic sense, like you described, and doing something that's ecologically sustainable, are not two different aspects of the wrong spectrum. They go together. If you do it well, they go together. You, just like the examples that you described, you just got to do it smartly. Now, if I just look at our company, we on top of it have the advantage to be in many areas like energy and like building automation, which are crucial for the energy usage, energy production. And if I just look at my research and development money, we are putting every year $6.6 billion up for research and development. This is roughly 53,000 employees in Siemens that do nothing else but research and development day in and day out around the 190 countries that we are in. If I now would split it up and would say how much of that is going into aspects that I would describe under sustainability aspects, I would say that roughly 3.5 billion already today, every year, go into those areas. Just to give you some examples, we are currently building together with one of our customers the most efficient and largest gas turbine. In the combined cycle mode, it's going to have 60% efficiency. This project alone is going to eat up $500 million for development money. Gives you a little bit of an idea that we need to do it together, because the money that has to be put behind it is huge. We've just investing into clean coal. I talked about coal a lot. Coal, many countries don't have that much of a choice. They need to use coal in their energy production mix. Well, the big question is, can we do coal gasification? Can we do sequestration of CO2? Can we find ways to safely bury the CO2? Are there other ways? And those are areas where we are investing heavily in, as much as we are having kind of energy consultants that we're sending out to industrial plants, do an analysis of an industrial plant, big consumption, I mean, about 20% of the energy problems and environmental problems are stemming from industry, as you correctly described. But now if we make it more efficient, if we have people that look at where is the most energy consumed, you'll find areas like old motors, for instance. Let's put new motors in. You'll find areas like it's an old air conditioning system. Or you can find a way, like in a large airport, to connect the heating system or the heating and ventilation system with a real-time scheduling system so that the finger only gets heated up or cooled down, depending on what you need, about 5-10 minutes before it's reused. And once the people are through it, you just forget about it again. There's a lot of technology around that is a helper to that, and I'm very, very optimistic that jointly we can do that in a much better way.
John Chambers.
I think business not only can be the stumbling block, it can be part of the solution, not just for how we do it as businesses, but how we partner with government, academics, NGOs, et cetera. And I think the closer businesses can tie corporate social responsibility to profitability and say it should be the and, not the or, the more effective we can be in driving that through. And I'll give you just two examples. We started Network Academies a decade ago in the U.S., and it trains young people in high school and college to get jobs in technology. It expanded so quickly across the U.S., we're now in 163 countries, 10,000 academies, 454,000 students. And when you face many of the issues we talk about today, it's about creating a middle class, it's about participating in an economic future, it's about solving healthcare or energy issues. The more you can tie the corporate goals to that, explaining that to your shareholders, motivating your employees, the more successful you're going to be. A simple issue called the Jordan Education Initiative that we did in conjunction with King Abdullah and Queen Rania, with the sponsorship of the World Economic Forum, brought together 17 different companies from the World Economic Forum, 17 Jordanian companies, 11 NGOs, and we not only focused on redoing the Jordan economy from a job creation, redoing their education system, but creating small companies in Jordan that would then prosper after we left. And once we did it well in Jordan, we then partnered and went into Egypt, we went into India, we went around the world with the programs. The point that I'm making is that if you look at what business brings, we bring an ability to outline a vision, a practical approach will the strategy get you there, and an execution of what you have to do step by step. And as you tie those results to it's also good for your bottom line in business, and we're one of the most successful, most profitable companies in the world, the more your shareholders will support that as well.
If I could make a comment following up on both of these last two comments, I have been extremely impressed at the role played by visionary CEOs who have provided important leadership in helping to organize a response to the climate crisis, and I commend them. But I think it's time for all of us to recognize that it is government that sets the rules within which business competes. And the rules that are currently in play now send the wrong signals. We are asking these business leaders, no matter how committed and socially responsible they are, to take on some competitors who are willing to cut corners. And one of the simplest, most powerful public policy mechanisms for giving business the right incentives is to get the tax system right. I think that it is high time, I speak specifically with regard to this country, but I think it applies in many other countries as well. I think that we ought to stop taxing payrolls and start taxing pollution instead and put a heavy tax on CO2 in order to send the right signals, more than offset it by a reduction in payroll taxes. And for politicians who are scared to death of the word tax, This is a revenue neutral proposal. And I know that the fear extends to being worried about the impossibility of explaining something that's complicated. And that's a shame. But that's where the rest of us come in. We have to insist on a higher level of honesty in our conversation of democracy so that we can entertain intelligent solutions like a CO2 tax in place of a payroll tax. Look, we are right now, without changes, we are heading right off a cliff. And in our darkest days, Abraham Lincoln said, we must disenthrall ourselves, and then we will save our country. That is the challenge, first and foremost, for us now with the climate crisis, to disenthrall ourselves, to break free of the cloudy thinking that calls global warming pollution an externality, an absurd label, which means we don't want to keep track of it, so let's pretend it doesn't exist. Well, the stuff we're pretending doesn't exist is the stuff that's causing this crisis. 70 million tons of it every single day we're dumping into the atmosphere. So business needs to get the right signals. If they can save money on taxes by reducing CO2, they will do it. People will do what you pay them to do.
There are a number of ways to send... There are a number of ways to send signals through an economy, through a market system. Carbon tax is one of them. Cap and trade is another. But let me ask John Chambers and Klaus Kleinfeld whether you agree with the basic proposition, which is that in a market system and a free society, it's the public sector's role to send those signals one way or another. And that in the long run, that's going to be necessary rather than relying simply on the voluntary efforts of business.
I think if there was one lesson learned over the last 2 days is that if any decisions are made in isolation and you impose your will upon others, there'll be natural resistance. I think to identify a problem, and clearly what President Clinton did in bringing this group together and then getting an environment where we could exchange views and saying, how do we address this together, that's the right approach. And I do believe the corporations will respond to tax policy, they'll respond to other incentives, and they'll also respond to very good examples, whether it's healthcare or otherwise. It's the top problem, in my opinion, facing many of the countries around the world. In the U.S., it is the top cost control problem of CEOs. So the more you can align those goals and say, how do you work together on them, or the more you can sit in a room and say, how do we accomplish this goal together, as opposed to just saying anything that has to do with taxes, the answer is no, is how do we practically approach it? And I think that type of give and take is very healthy, and I personally welcome that.
We're about to get to health, but Klaus, I want to give you a chance at this.
Yeah, well, I think we've seen some examples. I mean, there is a reason why Europe these days is leading in some of the regenerative energy areas. I mean, I can very well remember the times when I used to go up to Denmark to a little town called Skagen that was in the 70s and saw the first windmills used there by the farmers. Today, the windmill business is a big business. It can add up to go up to 5 to 6% of the world's supply of energy. We are very strong in windmills, and it's getting more efficient and bigger. But what we've learned from that, originally it started with tax incentives, significant tax incentives. It was extremely powerful and worked extremely well to get a jump start in that industry. However, you have to find the point where you then reduce it. Because if you don't reduce it, then it leads to business models that are not sustainable. Because literally, it's actually then preventing innovation, because then people are only doing it for the tax purpose. And that's not what you want. So in reality, in my view, you have to see it dynamically. And I think that's exactly on the line of what you suggested. To get a kickstart to something, see that you get enough of a push, and then you can use the money and get onto something else, because then the industry is sustainable and can grow by itself.
Let's stick with health a minute. John Chambers, Cisco's commitment here involved, as I understand, a reduction in greenhouse gas emissions. Can you tell us specifically what that commitment is, how Cisco's going to do it, and why it's good for your shareholders?
Often until you're challenged on something and you get to debating about it, you don't understand what's possible. And we are a company, partially because of the Internet, that kind of dreams and then say, how do you make dreams happen? after President Clinton, and interestingly enough, Tom Friedman, at a meeting with my senior leaders, challenged us to say think differently about becoming a green company. We went back and said, let's not do what we've traditionally done, more network academies, which we'll continue to do, or other events. Let's think about how we'd really change our mission policy. We then went back, and as basic as it sounds, we didn't know how much we were giving off. We broke it down by individual location, broke it down by travel, looked at a huge number, and we said, let's say, what would it take to take that down by a minimum of 10% run rate within 12 months? So a sense of urgency. As we broke that down, we said, how do we do this in a way that is right for our customers, right for our employees, and right for our shareholders as well? And what we found by thinking backwards, the problem, the strategy, and then the implementation, we were able to do it in a way that will, I think, very comfortably reduce this by a minimum of 10% in terms of Cisco's internal use by using new technologies and cutting our travel by 20%. While still increasing the amount of customer contact, which is a huge part of our DNA. We get all of our ideas from our customers. And so we're going to do that over the next year by using new technologies. You'd call it an advanced form of video conferencing, telepresence. So we identified a tipping point in technology, which allowed us to dramatically cut travel and still do what was important to our company's success. We then said, let's take the concept and expand it beyond. What are the other tipping points in technology? A tipping point right now is you have GPS systems, you have the capability of radio frequency ID, very small devices you could put on cars or other vehicles, wireless implementation. And so we went to a number of city leaders around the world and said, is there an opportunity to work together to rethink about how traffic occurs in your cities? How do you do this in a more efficient way from an emissions point of view? And how do you do it without having to build new highways? And we were honored to have three mayors volunteer for this. The mayor of Amsterdam, the mayor of Seoul, and Mayor Newsom, who's here from San Francisco, and say, how do we look at redoing this on a longer scale that will have huge impact in terms of emissions within each of our major cities? Then, just like our network academies, if the concept works, we will replicate it. If our own utilization of cutting travel and still hitting our corporate goals works, then why couldn't every other corporation in the world do the same scenario? So those are the two commitments we're making, one on our own, one that we're doing through partners.
Thank you. I'd like to continue for a second on health because the road to sustainability has a lot to do with opportunity and improved hope, and nothing is more central to a family's or an individual's life than health. And Klaus Kleinfeld, before he became chair of Siemens and CEO, was actually head of its health business. Can you take us right down, as I asked Eunice to do, right down to a village somewhere and explain to us the health business of the future and how that's going to help all of us, not just the wealthy?
Yeah, let me not take you down to a village. I think we are all pretty occupied for good reasons with our own health. So I think it is relevant for everyone here in the room. I think what everyone has most likely experienced when you move to another place and you go to see a hospital, the first thing that they ask you is they ask you to fill out gazillions of forms, and then you go to the next department, you do the same thing. The first thing they ask you to do is get a blood test, get a breast x-ray, and then we're going to interview you on all the things that you have had during your childhood and whatever your family history is. And you do that again and again and again. By the way, this is the nicest way how to experience this. The not so nice way is when you have an accident someplace where they don't know you and the ambulance brings you to a hospital where they don't have that information. For instance, that you are allergic to a certain contrast media, which is essential to do an x-ray of you, and then you're literally going to have serious problems while they are diagnosing you. All of that with today's technology can be solved because we're talking about the electronic patient record, a safe electronic patient record that literally you can carry around with you. And that's in my, and there are gazillions of examples of hospitals that have done that. Sometimes when I look at the healthcare industry looks like many of the industries that we've seen in the 70s, pretty archaic. When the West was first confronted with Japanese competitors, and when we all basically were worried about, wow, there's a big quality for low money coming around, what do we have to do? We put some more people on the end of the line and do quality inspection. That's not going to work. You're going to get killed. And we found the answer to that. The answer to that was process control. Get the process right the first time. But to get the process right the first time, you have to have best practice captured, because there are some that can do it better than others. There are some doctors that have 5,000 cases in their lifetime. They've figured it out. They know how to do it in an hour and a half, and get the patient out in 2 days. As long as we don't capture that best practice, we will not get the best out of the healthcare system. Basically, what I'm saying is there are ways around with healthcare IT and modern diagnostic equipment which can significantly improve the process and bring the cost down, and at the same time bring the quality up. What I see in the public debate very often happening, because people are not going to that individual hospital level, people are talking about how can we change the insurance model of it and fiddling around with the upper end of it instead of getting to the lower end, where in reality we have proven outcomes that can show that there you can at least save, I would say, 30% of the cost, plus improve the quality, which means improve our lives.
Thank you. We're going to talk a little bit about energy now, and I'm going to ask Eunice and Al Gore to help us along in that area. Eunice, your organization, Grameen, and mine, Environmental Defense, are planning a biogas project in Bangladesh. The aim of that, of course, is to try and make clean energy that's affordable available to the poor, and clean includes not just what goes on in the family's house in terms of what a baby and a mother breathe, but also involves the climate. Are these pipe dreams? Is something like this doable? Is the South condemned to repeat the path that the North has taken, or can you find a new path for us? And Al Gore, I'm going to ask you the same question. Are we condemned to repeat over and over what the industrial nations have already done?
Well, one good thing going for Bangladesh, there's no electricity in Bangladesh. 70% of the people have no access to electricity. And whatever electricity exists is very deceptive. Most of the time, it's not available. So we have no other way but to go to the alternatives. So we took from Grameen side, we created a company called Grameen Shakti, or Grameen Renewable Energy. And we brought the solar energy to go into the villages, and we make it a marketable commodity. Today, we have near 70,000 solar home system operating in Bangladesh. Soon, we'll be hitting the 100,000 mark. And our objective is to reach 1 million households with solar system. So it works in a very commercial way. Everybody loves it because this is one way to get electricity. We have mobile phones, very famous now, mobile telephone ladies all over the Bangladesh, and mobile phones everywhere. But there's no electricity. So we had to bring the solar panel to charge the batteries of the mobile phone. So that's another one. We did that. And then we came to biogas. Because in Bangladesh, Grameen Bank lends out annually over $800 million. Bulk of this money go into buying cows, selling milk. So we have lots of milk all around Bangladesh because of our activity itself. And also being an agricultural country, there are lots of cows everybody wants to raise. So we are coming up with a project with an idea that going to the villages and telling the household that what you'll do, we'll build you a biogas plant. With our cost, you don't have to spend a penny. So you get the gas to cook for cooking purposes. You don't have to chop up trees anymore. So gas will come from the excreta of the cows, and then you have the lights in the house. And the deal is, we take the slurry of the biogas plant. Slurry is a good organic fertilizer. So we sell the organic fertilizer, and that covers the cost of the plant that we built. The household didn't have to spend anything. They got the free gas, free cooking fuel, and so on. So this is now the one that we are popularizing, and now comes the Grameen Danone, another cow story. So we have another one built into the whole program, that wherever we buy our milk, this is the plant that they will go into. So soon we'll have lots of families around Bangladesh who are based on biogas, and in a very effective commercial deal where nobody is donating anything. It's completely taken care of in a sustainable way. So this is one area that we are very excited about.
Klaus, I just want you to know what's coming your way. Then Eunice and I are going to qualify the avoided greenhouse gases made possible by the methane biogas digesters, and you're going to buy them on the European carbon trading. Al Gore.
Well, in the long run, a sustainable society is based on renewable energy. Any questions? Just kidding. That is true of the very long run. But in the near and medium term, we have to find ways to use the available sources of energy without creating global warming pollution. And the developing nations are not condemned to repeat the mistakes that the developed world has made. And the good news is many of them are very clear about that and are looking to leapfrog the older technologies. But we have to find affordable and competitive ways to capture and sequester carbon. We have to make much greater use of renewable energy, and we have to look at conservation and efficiency. The words seem like just a buzz phrase now, but they do actually represent by far the greatest source of new energy and the best way to sharply reduce the global warming pollution. We are now in a new age in which we have supercomputers and distributed intelligence and new techniques for redesigning systems in order to eliminate these huge amounts of waste. A lot of the technologies that are commonplace throughout the world now are at least 100 years old. They're very inefficient and very dirty. And when we get over the hurdle of inertia and make the investments to adopt the new and better technologies, we get rid of the waste and the pollution at the same time. Automobiles, for example, completely waste about 90% of all the energy that we think we're getting out of each gallon of gasoline. Amory Lovins, who some of you here know, has gone further in calculating the amount of energy that goes to actually moving the passenger in the car, and not the several thousand pounds of metal that we take with us everywhere we go in a car. And that works out to less than 1% of the energy. Now, that's not a parlor trick with arithmetic. That is an accurate definition of the most attractive and available way to cut out most of the global warming pollution and the waste in our energy systems.
Do we have enough time to do all of this?
The scientists who I most respect, who have spent the most time on this question, believe that we may have as little as 10 years within which to make a bold start, a credible start, in changing the pattern of global warming pollution emissions. The short answer is yes, we do have enough time. But we don't have time to play around with this. The planet has a fever. If your child has a fever, you go to the doctor and you say, okay, it's only 1 degree, but then it's 2 degrees, and it's persistent, and it won't go away. And you ask the doctor what's wrong. Well, we've done that. The planet has a fever. And we've gone to the scientific community, and there is a consensus. And don't let anybody tell you there isn't. And by the way, those of you in the business community, I think there's a task for the business community in policing the irresponsible voices in the business community, like ExxonMobil, for example, spending all this money to intentionally confuse the public's understanding of what this is all about. But we've gone to the scientific community, and they've said, okay, yes, the fever is a sign of something badly wrong, and we have to stop putting all this pollution up there because that's what's causing the fever. Just in the last 3 weeks, we had a finding that the perennial ice at the North Polar ice cap melted for a record amount for the fourth year in a row. We now face the prospect of losing, unless we change within a decade, one of the planet's most important ways of cooling itself. New findings about the accelerated melting and thawing of tundra that contains enough carbon and methane to essentially double the amount of global warming pollution that's been put up there since the beginning of the Industrial Revolution. a third study showing that human-caused activities are warming the sea surface temperatures of the ocean in the areas where the hurricanes form. A fourth study showing that the correlation of increased wildfires on every continent tracks precisely with human-caused temperature increases. When I say this is a planetary emergency, I know it sounds shrill, but that is exactly what we're facing. How do we wake up to the reality of our circumstances and see the truth of the situation that we are in? We do have time, and we should not be paralyzed by the magnitude of this, but we have to summon the courage to look it squarely in the eyes and face it down. If we decide to do that, we have everything we need to do it. I said here last year, everything save perhaps political will, but that's a renewable resource. We need to get on with the active discussion of how to renew that resource, how to reawaken the conversation of democracy with integrity, to have the business community and the NGO community, activists and political leaders all involved in a common effort to organize a global response to this emergency.
Klaus, if you listen to the thoughts Al Gore just expressed, not the words, not the Americanism, but the thoughts, those are thoughts one finds today much more prominently expressed and historically have been expressed for a much longer period of time in Europe than they have been in the United States. So who's out of step with whom, and what can we learn from the European experience?
I would say no one is out of step, but some are catching up. And I like it, to be honest, because I think in Europe, for various reasons, I mean, one reason being because it's densely populated, another reason being because it was so densely populated and we had the Iron Curtain and we had literally a split Europe, where one Europe was starting to get very environmental conscious and doing quite a number of things, and the other part of Europe did not. But unfortunately, they were so close that everyone suffered from what the East did. I mean, I will never forget the moment in my childhood when I was swimming in this little river that was going through my hometown, Bremen, and the water police came and chased us out of the water. And from that day on, it was not allowed to swim in that
just
river.
For swimming. You weren't
just for swimming.
Putting anything in the water.
But to bear in mind, this was when I was 8. That's when it started. So we have quite a bit of a history of having gone through it. I remember very well that we were talking about respiratory problems in the northeastern part of Bavaria, because they are really close to the Czech Republic, and the smoke that was coming over from the east was so significant that it was doing damage. All of my family is from the east. I remember when I went over as a child, I was going through a street, and while I was turning the corner, there was a yellow cloud of smoke coming in front of me, you know, and all of my relatives told me it doesn't really make sense to wear a white shirt. It doesn't really make sense to clean the window. We've been through that. And I think that's where we've built up an understanding of, hey, this cannot go on like that. And people in my generation have seen it with their own eyes, felt the consequences, and are pretty committed to make a difference.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, we have about 4+ minutes left, and as a panel, we agreed before this started that we would try and end in a little bit of an unusual way that tried to build a bridge between you and us. We're sitting up here, we have lights in our faces, we're talking with microphones, and you've been sitting patiently out there around the table. The fact is, the issues we're talking about and the questions we're grappling with are not things to which we have the answers and you don't, and they're not even things that we know a hell of a lot more about than you do. There are very many remarkable people who deal with these issues every day in this audience. So what we've agreed to do is each member of the panel is going to close by sharing with you a question that they're working on to which they do not have the answer, and a problem they're wrestling with that is ongoing and that they would like your thoughts and your help in addressing. So I'm going to start, John, with you, if you would.
One of the things we wrestle with is that I believe that business, especially the internet, can make a huge difference. And if you look at what's going on in the Middle East and you frame it around a vision that countries to be successful will have a great education system, will have the right infrastructure, that's broadband everywhere, whether it's for healthcare or energy conservation, create an environment of innovation that saves the jobs and also supportive government working together. We're going to take some pretty good risks there to try to make a difference. And this is where you can't do it alone. In some areas, such as Jordan or Egypt, we're being pretty successful. In some of the others, perhaps Lebanon or some of the other areas, we're not being as successful. And so my question to the audience would be advice on that one and how to help to stay within the framework that we articulated, I think, as a panel.
Thank you. Eunice, problem you're working on?
Yeah, problems everywhere. So particularly in healthcare area, we've been hearing about the healthcare interventions. Healthcare for the bottom people, even 50% bottom or 25% bottom most, really doesn't go in, no matter what kind of system that you build, it's not available to the people. So how do we build those kind of things? One idea that I'd like to share with you and get your responses to it, build social business enterprises, people who are involved in healthcare or companies having their foundations who would like to get involved with healthcare. Build not just a charity hospital, but as a business hospital, but in a social business enterprise way, where there's no dividend coming out of it, but it will run as a business concept. Hospitals, clinics, mother care centers, and so on. This is on the healthcare area. Then there could be drinking water area. We can build social business enterprises on that if anybody would be interested. We'll be happy to participate with you. Another area is to build the solar panels. Today, the solar panels I was mentioning about our solar home system, it costs $3 at least per watt. How to reduce that cost? Can we bring it to a dollar? Can we bring it down to $1.50? If it comes to $1.50 per watt, it's a roaring success. It's anybody will use it, and it's business-wise, it's very successful, and so on. We'd like to create a social business enterprise to build this solar panels at that kind of cost and invite the research organizations to address this issue. So here is an open invitation. Anybody would like to build social business enterprises in a joint venture with us, we'll be very happy to join with capital and equities participation. And this is an invitation that I would like to extend to all of you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Klaus, a question you're working on.
Yeah, I think it is a global problem, and it is a complex problem which has a lot of levers, and that's one thing. And sometimes you're overwhelmed by the issues, but when I look at big changes in organizations and around the world historically, what I've concluded is they always start with the individual. There is no other way unless everyone does something different, and then a wave is hopefully created. Some islands are created. What I'm struggling with, how can we spark this, ignite it more, and how can we then bundle this to make it a movement? I've seen in my lifetime that this happened. The Iron Curtain came down. I would never have imagined that to happen. This was very much a groundswell movement and a historical opportunity. So I believe that we have an opportunity, and I would just hope that, I mean, events like this help us to ignite the spark of, hey, there is something I can do. You mentioned a couple of very good examples that are replicable for almost anyone, anywhere, don't require big amounts of money.
Thank you. Al Gore.
I need advice on how to more effectively change people's minds about the reality of this situation, how to get past a tipping point. I believe that the critical path the world must travel to cross that tipping point involves answering a preliminary question: how do we get the United States of America past that tipping point? I've long since come to believe that it has to happen at the grassroots level. When the political system is paralyzed, there has to be a mass movement. There has to be a change in attitudes. My wife, Tipper, and I are giving 100% of the profits from both the movie and the book to this new Alliance for Climate Protection that I'm not even on the board of, but a lot of great people here in the U.S. have put it together. Those in the rest of the world, maybe you can help with that. But the one question within this hierarchy of questions, how to get the U.S. past the tipping point, is how can you describe the incredible danger that we're facing in a way that mobilizes people instead of creates the paralysis of fear? Some of you know the cliche about the way the Chinese express the concept crisis, with two symbols back to back. The first in isolation means danger. The second by itself means opportunity. Together, crisis. Our single word in English, crisis, conveys the alarm but not the opportunity inherent in every crisis. And I think that the answer may be found in that duality, because this crisis is by far the most dangerous we have ever faced in the entire history of human civilization. But it also provides the greatest opportunity, not only for the new efficiencies in business and the new opportunities for lifting people in poor villages, not only new technologies and better enhancements to the quality of life, but something that's more important than any of that. I believe it gives us the opportunity to experience something that few generations ever know, and that is a common moral purpose that is compelling enough and urgent enough to allow us to transcend more of our limitations, set aside more of the bickering to which, as human beings, we are naturally vulnerable. In this country, the so-called greatest generation won the battle against fascism in the Atlantic and the Pacific simultaneously, and then they found that they had gained new moral authority and vision, and it enabled them to put in place the Marshall Plan and to convince the taxpayers to say, of course we'll pay for that, to establish the United Nations, to set in motion the unification of Europe, and to build the other international institutions that have given us decades of relative peace and great prosperity. We have depreciated that moral authority. Now, in our time, this crisis gives us a chance to rise, not only to meet this crisis, but in doing so, to gain the moral authority and vision to see these other challenges, like 20 million HIV/AIDS orphans in Africa alone, chronic civil wars fought by child soldiers, genocides, famines, the rape and pillage of the oceans and the tropical forests, millions dying of easily preventable diseases, to see those not any longer as political conundrums, but as moral imperatives. We are coming together as a global civilization in our lifetimes. We have to get our act together. And this climate crisis may, I believe does, give us the opportunity to rise, gain the moral authority, and gain the vision, not to become the self-destructive, selfish generation, but to become the next greatest generation. That's what I think we need to do with the climate crisis.
Can I ask you just a moment to broaden your applause and thank all four members of the panel for a terrific morning.
Wait, before you go anywhere, we're going to have the embodiment of Al Gore's call to action here.
Al, you got to wait. Richard Branson, come up here. One person has taken Al Gore's call to heart, and we just had an announcement at our very small press meeting, but I think the members of this body should hear the commitment that Richard Branson has made in this area and Al Gore's influence on it. So, gentlemen, the floor is yours. Come up.
Was it 4 or 5 years ago? I read a book called The Skeptical Environmentalist, and I believe what I read, and didn't do much about the environment. And then I just started reading other books. I met Ted Turner, who set up a wonderful environmental organization. And about a year ago, I got a knock on the door, and Al Gore had taken the trouble to come to England and to spend 2 hours with me, basically saying, look, you know, you're in a position where you might be able to make an influence, and if you could make a bold gesture, then maybe other people would make a bold gesture as well. And basically, what we've decided to do is we have transportation businesses, we have planes, we have trains. Planes, I'm afraid, do emit quite a lot of CO2. Obviously, trains less so. But what we've decided to do is to put any dividends, any profits, any shares, sales from those businesses into tackling environmental issues, and hopefully to be something like $3 billion dollars over a number of years. Yeah. Hey, thank you. But basically, I mean, there are people who say it's too late. As Al Gore said earlier, I don't believe it is too late. I think we do have a handful or two handfuls of years to get the ball rolling to address the problem. And you know, if we can develop alternative fuels, if people can take risks on developing the enzymes, if we can try to get cellulosic ethanol, then you know, and replace the dirty fuels that we're using at the moment, then I think we've got a great future. Anyway, thank you very much.
I just have one question. I didn't hear it on the list. I want to make sure. Are the expected profits from your rocket ships also going into this?
By the way, they are environmentally friendly rocket ships.
Let's give them a hand. This is great.
Here.
Thank you. Thank you.
You say this, and you sign it for me. It's your deal, and you sign it. It's yours. Keep safe.
Thank you, sir. Brilliant.
Like this, the old days.
This kind of money, we need someone to attest. Al's the enforcer. This is. Let's give him a hand. Wow. We're adjourned. Thank you. Let's give him another hand. They were great, and the whole panel. Great.
Ladies and gentlemen, the plenary session is now concluded. Your working sessions will begin at 2:30 p.m. Please proceed to your next destination. Thank you.